Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. This will be the Kakachupama Sutta, the discourse on the simile of the sword. And the theme of this sutta is how to practice patience, especially in the face of attack and criticism by others. Is the recording machine on? They were being, okay. I'm accustomed to seeing little tape recorders here. Okay, so this sutta opens because of a specific incident. It said that there are some suttas which the Buddha speaks of on his own initiative without any provocation by others, without any instigation by others. Then there are some suttas which the Buddha speaks because he's asked the question by others. And then there are some suttas which the Buddha delivers in response to a particular incident. And this sutta is one of these, falls in this last category. And the incident is that one particular monk named Moliya Poguna had been associating, the text uses the word ativelang, which means, it's translated over much, but it means literally over the boundary, beyond the boundaries. That is, he was frequently visiting when the Buddha established the order of nuns, he had the nuns living in premises which would be close to the residential facilities of the monks, but some distance away. And he didn't want monks to be associating very closely on a very friendly, intimate basis with bhikkhunis, because he knew that if a monk and nun become very, especially if they're younger, if they associate very closely, then feelings of affection are likely to arise, maybe beginning innocently as feelings of maybe respect, appreciation of each other's qualities. But given human nature, it doesn't take much for these feelings of affection, respect, appreciation to develop into emotional love. And once they develop into emotional love, then the ability of the monk and the nun to fulfill the spiritual life is compromised. And sometimes it will lead to incidents where a monk and nun together will disrobe and then go off and marry. And so the Buddha laid down quite strict regulations governing the relations between monks and nuns. Generally, when a monk goes to speak to nuns, he is not supposed to go alone, but in the company of another monk, or if another monk is not available, in the company of a layman. But according to the commentary, this monk, Moliya Poguna, was associating with the bhikkhunis for long periods of time. He would go to visit them even after the sun, when he would go to visit them, he would stay with them even after the sun was setting, which was a violation of one of the regulatory rules of the monk's code of discipline. And so the mutual feeling of affection between this monk and the bhikkhunis became so strong that they couldn't tolerate criticism from others. And so when other monks saw Moliapogona associating so closely with the bhikkhunis, they would criticize him for this. And sometimes they would criticize the behavior of the nuns, the bhikkhunis, in his presence. And when they did this, then he would become angry and upset. And sometimes he would even try to make what they call adhikarana. That means a legal case out of it. A legal case within the framework of the Vinaya, the code of monastic regulations. He would argue that his behavior was not a breach of the discipline. He would try to argue that the person who's criticizing him doesn't know the rules correctly. And he would claim that the person who's criticizing him has some personal grudge against him. And so he would make a big commotion when anybody would speak in dispraise of the bhikkhunis. And then, on the other side, if any monks spoke dispraise or criticism of Moliapogona in the presence of the bhikkhunis, then they also became angry and upset and also tried to make a case out of it. And so, eventually, a report about this, since the monks tried again and again to convince Moliapogona to change his behavior, but again and again he remained fixed, determined, obstinate in his ways. So eventually the monks saw that they had no alternative but to report the matter to the boss. So one monk went to the Blessed One and reported to him what was taking place. And so the Buddha then called Moliapogona into his presence. And then first, this is an important point to note, before the Buddha directly criticizes and corrects Moliapogona, first he asks him if this report about him is true. So the Buddha follows a correct legal precedent, protocol here. He doesn't harangue the monk at once, but he asks him if the criticism that's being voiced about him is correct. And so Moliapogona has to admit that this is the case. Okay, then the Buddha comes into the main theme of the sutta. Well, first the Buddha points out that it is not proper for himself, as one who has gone forth, that is, who has renounced the worldly life out of faith from the home life into, who's gone forth from, out of faith from the home life into homelessness, it is not proper for him to be associating so closely, so intimately with the bhikkhunis. Then he says that if anyone speaks dispraise of those bhikkhunis in your presence, you should abandon any desires and any thoughts based on the household life. This is a kind of coded text, which means that you should give up first any personal affection for the bhikkhunis, on a worldly type of affection. One can, of course, and should have affection for them as being sisters in the Dhamma, but one shouldn't have this worldly attachment to them of the type, such a type that when others criticize them, one becomes angry and upset. And then the Buddha gives him the instructions for maintaining patience and equanimity in the face of provocation by others. Okay, the Buddha says, this is how you should train yourself. The Buddha says, this is how you should train yourself. My mind will be unaffected, and I shall utter no evil words. I shall abide compassionate for his welfare with a mind of loving kindness without inner hate. That is how you should train yourself. Okay, so this is the method. When somebody is criticizing another person who is you have affection or admiration for, naturally the mind will start to become agitated and upset. One will get angry and will be disposed to speak angry words, to answer back the person who's attacking the third party. But in the first instance, one has to keep control over the mind. And the main instrument for doing this, though it's not mentioned in the sutta, is mindfulness or sati. When the mind starts to become angry, one should be immediately aware that anger has arisen in the mind. And when one applies mindfulness to observe the initial stirring of that angry, of those angry thoughts, then the angry thoughts don't have the opportunity to gather enough force, enough momentum to break out in angry speech. Then, okay, one is using mindfulness to keep watch upon the mind. So though angry thoughts might arise, but one just notes them as angry thoughts, and one makes, you can make the mental note, anger has arisen, and one makes a determination, a dhitana, a resolution, even though anger might be present in the mind initially, but I will keep check over my mouth. I will not utter any angry words. This, in a way, the advice of the Buddha is in some respects contradictory to some of the advice of present-day psychological advisors. They say when you feel angry, you should express yourself, get it out of your system. If you keep it bottled up, that's unhealthy, self-destructive. So speak your mind to others, release your anger. But if one does so with an angry mind, then you're just spreading the anger from your own mind to other people. But what the Buddha doesn't advise is suppressing or repressing the anger, forcefully subduing it. But one has to use skillful methods for transforming the anger and weakening its force. But it's most important at the outset not to speak angry words, because if you do so, that will just provoke anger and hostility in the other person. Then that person will be provoked to speak angry words to you, and then the angry exchange will go back and forth, each time becoming more intense, stronger, more vehement, till maybe it will eventually explode in physical violence. Okay, so you keep the mind under control, restrain the faculty of speech, then you train the mind to abide compassionate for the welfare of this person, assuming that the person who's speaking critically about the third party is doing so with an unwholesome frame of mind, with a desire to denigrate or disparage the third person. So then you recognize that this person is sowing seeds of suffering for himself or herself. And so you generate a mind of compassion, feelings of compassion for that person. And then you generate a mind of loving kindness. This is metta, the wish for the welfare and happiness of that person. And in any case, you keep the mind free from inner hate. Okay, so this is how, the Buddha says, that is how you should train yourself. Okay, this is the first instance, is where somebody is speaking dispraise of the bhikkhunis. Now the Buddha goes on to build up the scenario. Somebody is giving the bhikkhunis a blow with his hand, with a clod of earth, with a stick, or even with a knife in your presence, you should abandon any desires and any thoughts based on the household life and so on, and train yourself in the same way. But this, to my mind, it raises a problematic question. Does this mean that the Buddha here is recommending an attitude of complete passivity, a complete pacifism? And if that is the case, it seems almost to lead to a position of irresponsibility. If there are some people who are innocent, harmless people, and somebody comes and tries to harm them, and you are a stronger person capable of stopping them, should one just stay by passively and watch them inflict harm to these people and think, the Buddha says, I shouldn't do anything to prevent that person from harming these innocent people? Do I just radiate them? Suppose a man comes along with a knife and threatening to stab the bhikkhunis. Do I just stand there passively and think, may this assassin be well and happy, may he be free from suffering? I haven't found any cases like this discussed, at least none come to mind, any cases like this discussed in the suttas. But it seems most Buddhist teachers that I've spoken to or that I've heard discuss an issue like this say that one should act in such a situation and even act forcefully if necessary to prevent the aggressor from committing harm to innocent people. If the person is speaking, say, roughly to the innocent people, you could tell him, don't speak like that to these people. Your criticisms are unjust. Or if you want to criticize them, if you have some basis for your criticism, you should speak to them gently and softly and point out their faults with a mind concerned for their welfare. But you shouldn't speak to them roughly and bitterly. And if the person is attacking the innocent party physically, inflicting physical violence upon them, then if necessary, one might even use physical force to try to stop that aggressor from harming the innocent person. But one should do so with a mind of kindness and compassion for the aggressor, and one should try to avoid inflicting any kind of permanent or long-term physical harm upon the aggressor. And that would be the way I would suggest handling a situation like this. Does anybody have any other ideas about this? Yeah. Do you know any passages in the text where a situation arises where somebody is inflicting physical damage upon an innocent person? Okay, in the first part of this teaching, the Buddha deals with a case where somebody is attacking a third party, attacking them either verbally or physically. And now the Buddha directs the line of reflection to the person himself and says, if anybody speaks dispraise in your presence, I think that means dispraise of you, you should abandon any desires and any thoughts based on the household life. In other words, you should abandon any angry or agitated thoughts that might arise. And you should train in the same way that my mind will be unaffected, I shall utter no evil words. Then if anybody gives you a blow with a hand, with a clod of earth, with a stick or with a knife, again, you should train your mind in the same way. Again, this doesn't mean that if somebody is attacking you, that you just passively submit to the attack of others. One should try to avoid the attack, if possible, by going someplace else. If one is cornered and has no alternative, then one might even act physically in one's self-defense, trying to avoid inflicting any long-term physical damage upon this person. One might bring up the case. This is a very difficult case. Okay, suppose there is an innocent child in your presence, and the murderer is coming after that child, and you see that there's only, you get into a fight with the murderer, and you see that there's no other way to stop the murderer from murdering the child except to take the life of the murderer himself. What does one do in that case? I just throw this out for discussion. I don't want to try to answer it, but it would seem, plus the determinative factor in karma is intention or volition. Yeah. I haven't seen cases like that discussed in the text, but it would just seem to me that if somebody refrains from an action which is virtually a moral obligation in the condition, under those particular circumstances.
If you can take the life of the murderer with the intention of saving him from his own bad karma,
yeah,
then offset whatever negative karma you're getting. So you just, you know, it wouldn't be a holy,
yeah,
black karma,
yeah,
that you're generating.
Yeah.
But if you do nothing and refrain, maybe you're angry at the murderer.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you refrain from murdering him, you know, do you generate any bad karma for not saving? You didn't do anything.
Yeah. I have to say that that particular type of question, I've never seen it discussed explicitly in the text. But it would seem to me that a person who would refrain from saving the life of an innocent child who's being attacked by a vicious murderer would have a very morally blameworthy character.
I agree.
Yeah.
You're right. This is not describing it.
Yeah. Okay, anyway, let us go on. Okay, so again, if somebody comes and attacks you with a knife, then you should abandon any desires, any thoughts based on the household life, but you should train thus, my mind will be unaffected, I shall utter no evil words, and you permeate that person with compassion, with loving kindness, and restrain any thoughts of hatred. Okay, now the Buddha seems to shift the topic of discussion. But the commentary explains that even though the Buddha had given this advice to Moliya Poguna, but Moliya, instead of accepting the Buddha's advice with appreciation and agreeing to comply with it, remained quite obstinate in his determination to continue behaving in the same way. So he wasn't willing to change his behavior and to conform with the Buddha's advice. So now the Buddha refers back in time to an incident when he was able to give the monks just simple advice, and just by giving them that advice, they immediately would comply with it. And so he speaks about a time when the monks satisfied my mind, and I explain to them that I take my food in a single session, just in one meal a day. And by so doing, I am able to maintain good health and to live in comfort. And so now the Buddha is instructing the monks that they too should take their meals at a single session, and they too will enjoy good health and a comfortable abiding. That is, in the early days of the Buddha's ministry, the Buddha had not laid down any regulations fixing the time for the meals. But the Buddha himself made it a practice just to take one meal a day in the forenoon. And I would think that generally those monks who followed the example of the Buddha would also take one meal a day in the forenoon. They would go on their alms round in the morning or after the sun rose, collect enough food to sustain them through the day. Then after that meal, then they would only partake of liquids through the rest of the day. But other monks were free to go on alms rounds several times a day. Whenever they wanted, they could eat in the afternoon, in the evening, at night. But then the Buddha gave this advice that the monks should eat only in a single session. That was his advice. But he didn't make it a rule that monks have to eat only one meal a day. But he laid down a fixed period during which monks should take their food. That is from daybreak up to midday. And then he laid down one of the Vinaya rules that monks should not take solid food after midday. But monks, from daybreak to midday, they can take, if they want, two meals. Or if they prefer, they can take one meal. Even if they want, they could take three or four meals. So it's difficult to fit in more than two meals within that period of just 5 hours or so, 5 or 6 hours. Okay, but the Buddha's point here is that when the Buddha, when he gave the monks this advice, he didn't have to keep on insisting that they follow it, but he just gave them one instruction and they immediately complied. And then the Buddha illustrates this, and the Buddha uses the expression, I had only to arouse mindfulness in them. In other words, to make them aware of his intention, and they immediately would comply. And then the Buddha uses a simile to illustrate this. This is like a chariot which is connected with thoroughbred horses, and there's a goad lying ready. Then a skilled driver of chariots comes. He gets into the chariot, picks up the reins in one hand, the goad in the other, and he just gives a little shake on the reins, and the horses immediately start moving. And they'll go in any direction he steers them in. Okay, and now the Buddha gives his teaching a wider range of meaning, or sets it in its full context, by explaining the basic purpose of training in his doctrine and discipline. The basic purpose is to abandon unwholesome states and to cultivate wholesome states. The unwholesome states, these are all mental states which are connected with the defilements or kilesas, any types of states of greed, aversion, or ignorance, or any of their offshoots. And so the first purpose of leading the spiritual life is to abandon, to overcome, to eradicate these unwholesome states, and then to cultivate the wholesome states, the virtuous, purifying states. These would be the states which are collected into the five spiritual faculties, the seven factors of enlightenment, the Noble Eightfold Path. And so it is when all the unwholesome states are abandoned and all the wholesome states are fully developed that one reaches fulfillment in the doctrine and discipline. And again, the Buddha uses a simile to illustrate this. He compares it to a person who is taking care of a grove of sal trees. Sal trees are trees which grow in South Asia, very big, lofty trees which give out strong branches, and in season they bear very beautiful flowers with a very beautiful scent. And so if this person is cultivating a grove of sal trees, and then the sal trees are being, the little sal trees are being choked with weeds, the person has to perform two operations. refers to foster the growth of the salt trees, he has to remove the weeds. Then, as part of the, we call the negative side of the process, he has to cut down or cut off and throw out crooked saplings that rob the sap of the growing trunk of the tree. And then he has to clean up the inside of the grove. Then the positive side of the nurturing of the sal grove is to look after the growth of the well-formed saplings, to see that they grow properly, to provide them with fertilizer, with sufficient water. And if he does so, then month after month, year after year, the sala trees will grow up strong and healthy and will send out their branches and will bear their beautiful flowers. Okay, now the Buddha returns to the theme of patience, and he gives a story to illustrate the importance of eliminating anger, not only at the gross surface level of the mind, but also subtle tendencies to anger which might be lurking deep within. He gives a story about a certain lady of good family whose name was Videhika, and she had a reputation for being very gentle, meek, and peaceful. But she had a servant whose name was Kali, who was generally skillful in her work. But Kali wanted to test her mistress to see whether she was really as gentle and meek and peaceful as she was reputed to be. So Kali started to get up later and later each day. And then each time she would wake up late, the mistress would start getting angry with her. And day after day, the mistress, Videhika, would become angrier and angrier, until she lost her temper completely and hit the maid with a rolling pin and injured her, cut her head so that she was bleeding. I have to say I don't want to excuse the mistress from her behavior, but it seems that if the servant is working for the mistress, for her lady, that she shouldn't be waking up late in the day. Okay, so now the Buddha applies this to the case of a monk who might have, on the exterior, he might appear to be very gentle, extremely meek, very peaceful, as long as he is not touched or attacked by harsh types of speech. But, the Buddha says, it is when disagreeable courses of speech touch him that it can be understood whether that monk is really kind, gentle, and peaceful. And even though the Buddha speaks about this in relation to a monk, but this could be applied to anybody. People can present very serene exteriors as long as they are in command of their life situation. But it is when they are meet with affliction, with adversity, that you could see whether they become upset and despondent or not, or able to maintain their equanimity. And it is when people are attacked by others that one could see to what degree they've really mastered the development of patience. So this is why sometimes in Buddhist monastic traditions, skillful teachers will put their pupils deliberately create situations which put them into trouble, into difficulties, to see whether they will be able to maintain equanimity or whether they explode with anger and impatience. Sometimes they will criticize them very harshly just to see how they will respond. Okay, next the Buddha speaks about five types of speech which others might use when they speak to you. And I classify these five according to five categories. First, according to the time, the speech might be uttered at the right time or at the wrong time. For example, the right time would be if one wants to criticize a person. One will choose a time when that person is not occupied with some other activity. Or you might choose a time when the person is alone, not in the presence of others, so that you don't embarrass the person. You'll choose a time when the person is in reasonably good health. You wouldn't want to attack a person who's sick, suffering from a lot of pain. And then the wrong time for speaking to a person would be when that person is engaged in activity, or when the person is sick and indisposed, or when the person is in the company of others. If you come to a person when he's surrounded by his friends, and then you point out that you forgot to sweep the floor this morning, why don't you attend to your duties properly, then the person becomes very upset. So the proper time to address the person is when you're alone with them. Unless you know the person is an aggressive person, then you might have to come with somebody else to speak to him. Okay, then when you speak to somebody, especially when you're criticizing that person, you have to speak about something that is true, not malign the person with false rumors that might be spreading about him. And if you're unsure whether the criticism that's being voiced about the person is true or not, then you can inquire, is this report correct? And then third point is important. When you speak to the person, then generally one should speak to that person gently, not harshly. So this doesn't mean the person will always find one's criticism agreeable, likable. In the last class, I spoke about the five types of speech that the Buddha uses when addressing others. And sometimes when the Buddha speaks to his disciples or even to other people, he'll use speech which is disagreeable to them, which disturbs them, which they find afflictive. But the Buddha doesn't, when he speaks, he doesn't speak harshly to them. He could speak sternly and strictly, but his words are always uttered gently. Soft speech. Okay, then when one speaks to others, one's speech might be, has an underlying motive or purpose. This purpose can be either to benefit others, to help them, or to hurt them and harm them. And so one should always speak to them with the intention of benefiting them, not with the intention of harming them. And then the fifth factor is the attitude or state of mind behind the speech. When one speaks to others to criticize them, one should arouse within oneself a mind of loving kindness. So before one goes to the person to speak to them, one might just pause silently for a few moments and just think, may this person be well, may this person be happy, may the person be well, may the person be happy, till one feels the flame or glow of loving kindness arise in the mind, then one can speak to them. But one shouldn't speak to them when one has a mind boiling over with anger, with hate. These are the five guidelines that we should observe when we speak to other people. But here the Buddha is discussing the case of the courses of speech that others might adopt when they speak to you, to us. In this case, we don't have any control over that. We could only control the way we speak to others. And so here the point that the Buddha wants to make is that when others speak to you, whether they speak at the right time or the wrong time, whether they say what's true or what's false, whether they speak gently or harshly, with the intention of benefiting us or harming us, whether they speak with a loving mind or a hating mind, still one should maintain this reflection that helps one sustain patience. That is, one reflects or trains oneself. Our minds will remain unaffected. It's unaffected by hatred, by anger. And we shall utter no evil words. We shall abide compassionate for their welfare with a mind of loving kindness, without inner hate. Then the Buddha goes on to develop this theme. First, the Buddha says, we shall abide pervading that person with a mind imbued with loving kindness. And then starting from that person, one expands the mind of loving kindness until it becomes all-encompassing, all-embracing, so that one can expand the mind of loving kindness until it includes the whole world. And then one is pervading the entire world with a mind suffused with loving kindness, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility and without ill will. Yeah, the Pali Tadaramanang. Tadarambanang. You're starting from that person. So when usually when one begins a loving-kindness meditation and does it systematically, one begins with oneself, then one takes friendly people, then neutral people, then hostile or aggressive people. But that is when one is training oneself to develop loving-kindness systematically. And if one hasn't undertaken that practice, then when one has contact with aggressive, hostile people, it's very difficult to arouse a mind of loving kindness towards them. But if one has familiarized the mind or habituated the mind to the meditation on loving kindness, then when one meets an aggressive, hostile person, then one has a kind of bank reserve, a bank account of loving kindness to draw upon. So in your imagination, you've already practiced developing loving kindness towards a hostile person, even if you haven't met such a person before, but you create, as part of the meditation, imaginative situations where somebody is attacking you, speaking harshly and roughly or abusively to you, then you practice developing loving kindness towards the person in that situation. Or else you might have everybody has encountered situations where somebody is being aggressive and hostile to you. So then you practice developing loving kindness towards the hostile person in the meditative situation. And then this builds up a certain force or momentum of loving kindness that you can draw upon for unexpected situations you encounter in everyday life. So now when you meet a really hostile, vicious, aggressive person, and that person starts speaking roughly to you, or attacking you violently, even physically, then you can build up, you revert to your mind of loving kindness, draw upon that inner reserve of metta, of loving kindness, and direct the loving kindness towards that aggressive person. And then you expand that loving kindness and Now the most difficult individual person to develop loving kindness towards is the hostile one. So when you bring up the loving kindness and focus it on the hostile person, assuming that person isn't physically tormenting you so that you don't even have the leisure to develop your meditative reflection. Okay, so then you build up the loving kindness towards the hostile person, then you start expanding it towards all beings in general, till you can radiate the loving kindness throughout the whole world and suffuse the whole world with loving kindness. In this way, you could even transform the person who is attacking you. I remember a long time ago, I read, it was an autobiographical sketch of an Italian monk from many, many years ago. His name was Venerable Lokanatha. He was quite an extraordinary monk who would undertake some very daring feats. I think this must have been in the 1940s, even earlier. He was walking from Europe to India, or from India to Europe, I don't remember which direction, with just his alms bowl subsisting on alms round. And when he passed through some Middle Eastern country, I think it was Turkey or Iran, one of these countries, a group of thugs captured him and they wanted to rob him, but he didn't have any money, and they kept on demanding, "Give us your money, we know you have money, give us, where are you hiding it?" And he said, "I don't have any money." And then they said, "Well then, if you're not going to give us any money, we're going to kill you." And he said, just occurred to me, I don't know what language he was communicating with them. But then, anyway, he said, "If you're going to kill me, that's okay, but before you do so, I'm a religious person, I am a monk. Please give me a few moments, 10 minutes, just to say my final prayers." He spoke in terms that they would understand. And so even though they were very vicious people, but still they had enough sympathy to agree to give him 10 minutes to say his final prayers. And so what he did was to go into the meditation on loving kindness and radiate the loving kindness towards these potential murderers. And just while he sat there radiating the loving kindness towards them, they were just waiting, when is he going to get his prayers over? When are they going to get his prayers over? But somehow the force of this venerable's mind was so strong that the murderers started to soften, soften, soften. Their hearts melted, and when the 10 minutes were up, and Venerable Lokanatha turned to them and said, "I've finished my prayers, do what you want," they said, "Oh, we can't murder you. Please, you are a religious man, please continue with your journey." Okay, so now to illustrate the quality of this mind of loving kindness that has to be developed, the Buddha brings in 4 similes. Again, they're 4 very wonderful similes. The first is that of a man who comes along with a hoe, or perhaps the word means a shovel and a basket, and he thinks he's going to dig at the earth. And by digging away at the earth, he's going to eliminate the earth. I'm taking one scoop after another, I'm going to get rid of the earth. I remember in my childhood, my parents told me that we were living in New York, China is on the other side of the earth. So I thought, I want to go to China. So I went into my backyard and I took a little, you know, kids, they have these little shovels and pails, and I started digging away, thinking I will dig away and get through the earth and come to China. Took me about 50 years to get there, not by digging, but by going through the rest of my life till last September, October, we wound up in China. Okay, so the man comes thinking, I'm going to remove the earth by digging. And so no matter how hard the man might work at digging away the earth, all he gets is fatigue and weariness, weariness and disappointment. And the reason is because the earth is deep and immense. It is not easy to remove it. It's not really possible to remove it by digging it away. And so this is the quality of loving kindness that one should develop with one's mind. One should develop a mind which is as vast and as deep and immense in loving kindness as the earth. So if somebody comes and attacks one with violent, with angry words, with vindictive speech, with physical violence, one's mind is no more disturbed, no more perturbed. Then the earth can be removed by digging it away with a shovel. The second simile is that of a man who comes along with some buckets of different colored paint and a paintbrush and thinks, I will draw pictures on empty space. And so he takes his brush, puts it into the bucket of the red paint, starts painting, maybe I will paint a landscape, starts painting the ground, then he goes for the green paint, thinks I'll paint some grass, takes some blue paint, I'll paint the sky, goes for the white paint, I'll paint some clouds, goes for other colored paint, paint some figures in the picture. But all the time he's drawing this picture not on a canvas, not on a wall, but just on space. And so will that man be able to make pictures appear on space? And of course the monks say, no. And the reason is because empty space is formless. And the Pali word here, it's an interesting word, anidasana, that it doesn't manifest anything. It's not a suitable vehicle or surface for manifesting pictures. And so again, the man who comes to paint pictures in empty space only becomes weary and fatigued and disappointed. So in the same way, when other people come and attack a person who has developed a mind of boundless loving kindness, so they speak bitter words, but there are no ripples of anger in the mind of the loving person. So they speak angry words, again, no ripples and waves of anger. So they speak cruel words, no ripples or waves of resentment appear. The mind just remains even, calm, poised, and bright and radiant with loving kindness. Okay, then the third simile. A man comes with a blazing torch and he approaches the river Ganges and thinks he's going to evaporate the river Ganges, to burn it up, to make it disappear with the fire from this blazing torch. And so he comes to the river Ganges, he holds the torch over the water of the river, thinking, evaporate, evaporate, river Ganges, disappear, river Ganges. Then he might even thrust the torch into the river, thinking, this way I'll make it disappear. But his torch goes out. He lights it again, tries again and again and again, but no matter how hard he tries, he can never make the river Ganges evaporate and disappear. And so in the same way, when a person has developed the mind of loving kindness, other people might approach you with their own blazing grass torch, that is, their minds flaming with anger and hatred. and they speak angrily to you, bitterly to you, aggressively to you, harshly. But just as the river Ganges doesn't evaporate and disappear, so your mind of loving kindness doesn't disappear. But the mind remains balanced, poised, calm, settled, composed, and still cool, cool, and moist with loving kindness. The fourth simile, I have to say, I can't form a very clear picture of it, but I just will read it. There's something called a catskin bag. That's the way this term is translated. And it's been processed in such a way that it's incapable of giving out any sound. And then a man comes with a stick or with a potsherd and rubs it and thinking, I'm going to make this catskin bag give off a sound. And he tries, he rubs it, but it doesn't give off any rustling and crackling. In a similar way, when others come and then attack the person with a mind of loving kindness, his mind doesn't give off any crackling or rustling of thoughts of anger and hatred. Okay, so then now in the final part of the sutta, the Buddha takes what we might call the most extreme case. This is the famous simile of the two-handled saw, the simile that gives the sutta its name. Okay. If one is, say, traveling through a forest, this is actually the case almost that this Venerable Lokanatha encountered, and then bandits capture you, and they tie you up, and they start to cut you up, to sever you limb by limb with a two-handled saw. Two-handled saw, there's one handle here, another handle there. One person holds one handle, the other holds the other, and they have your limbs stretched out, your arms stretched like this. They take the right arm, start sawing away till that comes off. Then they turn to the left arm, start sawing till that comes off, sawing away the legs. So this would be almost the most extreme type of torment conceivable. At least one of the most extreme types conceivable. So then the Buddha says, even in such a situation, if you give rise to a mind of hatred towards them, you would not be carrying out my teachings. But rather, you should train yourselves thus. Our minds will remain unaffected. Maybe I shall learn a lesson from my friend Venerable Anālayo and ask, let's all read this together. Then it will make a stronger impression on your mind. Okay. 1, 2, 3. Our minds will remain unaffected, and we shall utter no evil words. We shall abide compassionate for their welfare with a mind of loving kindness without inner hate. We shall abide pervading them with a mind imbued with loving kindness, and starting with them, we shall abide pervading the all-encompassing world with a mind imbued with loving kindness, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility and without ill will. That is how you should train. Okay, then the Buddha concludes by saying that if you keep this advice on the simile of the saw constantly in mind, do you see any course of speech, trivial or gross, that you could not endure? And the monks say, no, Venerable Sir. And so the Buddha says, therefore you should keep this advice on the simile of the saw constantly in mind, and that will lead to your welfare and happiness for a long time. And that is the sutta. In a way, this has been, this advice of the Buddha has been a guideline for Buddhas through the centuries. So when Buddhas in different periods have been persecuted by followers, say, of other religions, even during the medieval period when missionaries from other religions came to Buddhist countries and tortured and killed Buddhist monks, the Buddhist monks would not rise up in violence and retaliate and fight forcefully against them, but they would be guided by this principle of patience, forbearance, endurance, harmlessness. And generally what served as their exemplar, as their guideline, would be the simile of the sword, which is very, very well known in the countries of South, Southeast Asia. Okay, any questions, comments? Oh, you mean homosexual activity? I don't recall any passages which address that problem specifically, except that within the Vinaya Pitaka, it discusses the first, it's called the first parajika offense, is the offense, the first type of offense leading to expulsion from the order. And that is Maitunadama, sexual relationship. And cases are reported in that part of Vinaya of first of a monk who has sexual relations with women, and that is the initial case which induces the Buddha to lay down this rule of discipline. Then other cases come up of monks who have homosexual relationships, and in those cases too the Buddha says, whether it's a woman, a man, or an animal, doesn't matter, but if there's any penetrative intercourse, then it's the grounds for expulsion. And then there are also, under the cases of Sangha Disesa, these are cases of sexual contact which are not penetrative, so they do not lead to expulsion. But again, whether it's heterosexual or homosexual, it's ground, it's an offense. Any further questions? Yeah, sure. Okay, that's good.
Yeah.
Okay. Actually, I thought it would take longer to get through the sutta, so I skipped over that passage, which just seems to rephrase in a somewhat different way points made earlier. Okay, here the Buddha is speaking about, or contrasting, two monks. One monk complies with advice, that is, he's easy to admonish because he has some ulterior motive. He wants to get some benefits, external benefits, to get gifts of robes. He knows, for example, a junior monk, that if he accepts the advice, the instruction of a senior monk, then maybe the senior monk will give him a robe as a gift. Or if the senior monk gets some specially delicious alms food, we'll give him an alms food. Or if he's shown to be very meek and humble when they're giving out rooms or cottages, he'll get a nice cottage, and so on. But the Buddha says that this is not the real way to be compliant and easy to admonish, easy to instruct. Because when such a monk doesn't get the rewards that he expects, then he becomes rebellious and obstinate and self-willed, recalcitrant, and doesn't accept advice. Sometimes such a monk becomes arrogant and overbearing. But the Buddha says that the true way that a monk should behave is that he should make himself easy to admonish, easy to instruct, because he honors, respects, and reveres the Dhamma. That is, because he understands that the instructions given to him are in accordance with the Dharma, with the Buddha's teaching, and that they will lead to his spiritual growth, to his growth in wholesome qualities. And so he sees that to comply with this advice will be beneficial to himself. And because he understands that this will be truly beneficial, not because he'll get some external rewards, but because he will be able to train his mind more efficiently to attain real wisdom and understanding, and eventually to gain realization of the Dhamma. And so accepting this advice for the purpose of making progress in the Dhamma, that's what it means to accept the advice out of respect and reverence for the Dhamma. Is that clear? Anything to add?
I have a comment.
Yeah, good. Speak up, speak up.
I have seen and heard cases where people abuse the simile of the Susong, especially that part, when disagreeable chords of speech touches him, and it can be understood whether that bhikkhu is really kind, gentle, and peaceful.
Yeah.
So a lot of people like to test other people's water.
Yeah.
Now, this, I've seen monastic trying to test laity, whether they are, and then get angry at them, and then say to them, oh, I was just trying to test you, whether you are a good practitioner. And I've seen laity try to test monastic. I see that as an abuse of, misunderstanding what, this...
Yeah, I think one has to apply that very, very cautiously.
Yeah, many people like to use the calling it an expedient.
And
then when I think of the word expedient means, sometimes I think about the koan of the Zen masters trying to test their students.
Yeah.
But the interesting thing, that's my feeling, is that out of the 2,000 students that study with that teacher, probably only one gets some kind of realization.
Yeah, yeah.
The other 999 are probably angry inside. This is a comment I have.
Yeah, I think using this, testing other people, it should be done, I think, only by a really accomplished master who knows, who's mastered his own mind pretty well, very well. Otherwise, it could become very dangerous. One could arrogate to oneself the privilege of the thought that one is an accomplished master, and one goes around testing others, provoking others, and you just get into quarrels and conflicts with them. You hurt their feelings.
Possibly so.
I've heard stories about some of the Achans, the masters of Northeast Thailand, who sometimes speak quite roughly to their pupils as a way of sometimes testing them, or at least the ostensible purpose is to help them to develop patience. Well, I remember my and my first Buddhist teacher sometimes used to go and drink beer and say that this is his way of testing my patience. And I thought I would test his patience. sometimes like going and hiding his fear. But he got angry at me. Any other comments? Or okay, then we will stop for the evening. And next week, we come to a new section. It's the Chula Kama, the... No, not the... Mahadukkha Kanda Sutta. I can't find my... I put it on the back. Don't be frightened, by the way, by the title of this section. Just in retrospect, I see that I could have lost all my pupils when I made up this outline, the call to renunciation, the wretchedness of the worldly life, the dangers and sensual pleasures, the misery of samsara. There'll still be a fair number of jokes and many beautiful, beautiful illuminating similes from the sutta. So please come. Does everybody have that sharing of merit sheet? Everybody has it? Let me see that I make sure I get the right sheet. Okay, so we share the merits in closing. One, two, three. Akasata chabumata devanaga mahidika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu sasanam. Akasata chabumata devanaga mahidika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu desanam. Akasata chabumata devanaga mahidika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu mang parang. Etavata ca ammehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe devanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavata ca ammehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe bhutanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavata ca ammehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe satanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Meaning, may all the deities and dragon spirits, all the powerful deities and dragon spirits dwelling in space and on the earth, rejoice in this meritorious deed, and for a long time protect the Buddha's teaching, for a long time protect the exposition of the teaching, and for a long time protect myself and others. Whatever merits we might have accumulated through this activity of speaking Dhamma and listening to Dhamma, may all the deities rejoice in it and achieve all success. May all the Buddhas or harmful spirits rejoice in it and achieve all success. And may all living beings rejoice in it and achieve success. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.